Okey-doke, so you all, I hope, recognize the big arc. So we have, follow the arc of the Big Dipper to Arcturus in the constellation Bodies, and use Spear, Spica, and Virgo. And Regulus is the kind of center of the big arc in the constellation Leo. So next time it's on to the summer triangle, and then after that we'll do the winter hexagon, which has lots more stars in it, obviously. Questions? So we're kind of working on the geology of the terrestrial planets, I'll say. In saying that, I'm kind of including the moon as a planet, which of course it isn't, but it is a pretty big object. And we're kind of trying to make some sense out of this long list of numbers that we have for the planets. And here we have the terrestrial planets. And you can see that in lots of regards, Venus and Earth are pretty similar. And in lots of regards, the Moon and Mercury are pretty similar. They look the same. One of the key ways they are very different is in their overall density. So if we uncompress the planets, that is to say, the Earth is bigger than Mercury is, so the core of the Earth is under greater pressure than the core of Mercury is. If we were to kind of uncompress the planets, it would turn out that Mercury would have the highest density. You can see that, technically speaking, Earth has the highest density, but that's just because the Earth is under higher pressure, so the material is more compressed. Mercury actually has more high-density stuff in it than the Earth does. And you can see the Moon among these so-called terrestrial planets is going to be the least. And our explanation for that was that the iron is lacking, by and large, on Moon. It has an iron core, but it's a pretty small iron core. And we think that we had this kind of grazing collision, which kind of knocked off the crust of the Earth and the crust of the impactor, and ended up forming the Moon. Not at all recently, very early on in the formation of the solar system, essentially 4.5 billion years ago. So as the last bits of pieces were roaming around, that's one of them nicked the Moon and nicked the Earth and produced the Moon. The Moon is not geologically active. So the Earth has, as we'll see, a totally different geology from anyone else, right? We've got these plates that are moving around. We have volcanoes on the edge of these plates where we have collisions, right? So here we have, for example, this transform fault outside of California. We have one plate going one way, one plate going the other. They stick, and as a result, we get lots of earthquakes there. This is the so-called ring of fire, where we have lots of volcanoes surrounding the central Pacific plate. Nothing like that anyplace else in the solar system. And we're going to need to understand it. So everything else is, in some sense, a one-plate planet. Things aren't moving around relative to each other. So if you just look at the Moon with your eye, you can kind of see the man in the Moon face, which consists of darker material contrasting with the lighter material. The darker material are the mara. They're the flood basalts. Basalt is a very dark rock. The lighter region are the highlands made of a more felsic rock, anorthosite. And you looked at this through the telescope and you could see lots of these impact craters which sprinkle the surface of the Moon, with many more impact craters in the highlands than in the mara, which is a clear sign that the mara are relatively recently formed, say 3.5 billion years ago. So relatively recent maybe, but not by Earth standards, where anything over 100 million years old is pretty old. There's some hint that there was a past magnetic field, and we do think that we've got a liquid iron core, so that's possible. Generally speaking, we think that fast spin is going to contribute to a magnetic field. But we'll see that Mercury, which is spinning even slower, has a magnetic field. So the 1 month spin rate probably isn't a reason to reject the possibility of a magnetic field on the Moon. So we got highlands, mara, impact craters. When impact craters occur, they spit out rays of material, which make kind of linear features on the surface of the moon. Over time, those linear features will be erased by other meteor impacts. So we only see rays for the youngest craters. Rills are things that kind of look like stream beds, except there was never water on the moon, so what we think was flowing through those was liquid rock, magma. Kind of no surprise, low escape velocity. There's not going to be an atmosphere on the moon, or for that matter on Mercury. Right? So here we've got escape velocities, moon being the lowest of all of them. Kind of no surprise, no atmosphere. So we won't be talking about meteorology today. The book talks a lot about the so-called late heavy bombardment, and that's something different from what is being proposed here. So this is an older slide which proposes that the rocks kind of got used up in the solar system uniformly, so that there were lots of impacts circa 4 billion years ago, and it's been less and less and less and less overall. Recently, people have been concentrating on the fact that a lot of the rocks that were brought back by Apollo have pretty much the same age, between 3.8 and 4 billion years old. So there's some speculation that there was a sudden peak, a sudden increase in the number of craters that were being produced at around 4 to 3.8 billion years ago. So hypothetically, what would be the case with the Earth is when the cratering decreased, say 4.1 billion years ago, the Earth probably had a solid crust, and then it was shattered again by all of these rocks coming in. So again, on Earth, we have to look hard to find rocks that are more than 4 billion years old, and we don't really find whole rocks that are that old, but individual mineral crystals go back to about 4.4 billion years old. So the book kind of makes a big deal about the, I don't know if I believe in the late heavy bombardment, but it's a current theory at least. So the moon has big differences between the near side and the far side, right? So on the side we see, we've got all these mara. On the other side, it's almost all highlands. And, you know, it's kind of no surprise that if there is a difference in the kind of shape of the moon, that side is going to end up facing towards the Earth, right? Because there's a tidal force. But, you know, why should there be this big difference between one side of the moon and the other? And it probably indicates some really big collisions that just happen to hit one side as opposed to the other. And we'll see a repeat of this for Mars. Mars also is pretty not symmetrical, in contrast to Venus, which is pretty symmetrical. So in any case, the moon is not kind of spherically symmetrical. It's pretty much just on the near side where we have all of these mara. Now, long ago, we commented that we can measure that the moon is currently receding from the Earth. So if we kind of run the movie backwards, the moon used to be a whole lot closer to the Earth. And there's pretty good so we think from various geological records of lake deposits and ocean deposits, we can count the number of tides per month. And there's pretty good evidence that the moon was hugely closer, that you might have months of just a week or something like that. In the billion year past. We do have seismometers on the moon, so we do have some seismic evidence for the interior of the moon, and it's really a reanalyzation of that data that has given us this picture of the interior of the moon, right? So here's a graph of the sound velocities versus depth, and here's kind of how they're interpreted. Thick crust on the far side, thinner crust on the near side. The idea is that these mara are just fillings in of old impact basins. So you had a big impact and it left a hole, and 100 million years later we had these flood basalts come in and kind of level things out. So the moon is a very seismically quiet place, kind of unfortunately, so there's not a lot of great data. And unlike the Earth, where earthquakes tend to be a phenomenon of the crust and in particular plates in collision, the moonquakes happen at great depth. So I looked at pictures of Mercury. Looks very similar to the moon. I guess one of the things I would comment on is we tend to see maps of the moon that look white, and it's really quite dark. So both moon and Mercury have albedos that are about a tenth, so kind of at best a very dark gray for the actual color of the moon. So we usually see the moon against a black sky, so it looks whiter than it actually is. And since it's colorless, even if it's dark colorless, it's going to look white. So Mercury has a magnetic field, so we know it has a conducting convecting liquid, and it has a much higher, we were commenting before, if you uncompress it, it has a higher density than the Earth has, so it has a larger iron core than the Earth. We think it has the same inner-outer structure of the Earth. That's kind of recent data from MESSENGER, which is still in orbit around Mercury taking data. So it probably has a formation history pretty similar to the moon. Questions on the geologically inactive planets? So one thing I didn't get around to talking about was kind of the funny rotation of Mercury. So the moon is a synchronous rotator. So as it orbits around the Earth, it keeps the same face towards the Earth. And presumably the moon isn't a perfect sphere. It has some sort of asymmetry. And we can see that for that matter just from the location of the mare, right? So it has some asymmetry. So it's going to be more favorably pointed towards the Earth. And it is important to remember that stuff wants to be as much away from the Earth as it wants to be towards the Earth. So if the moon were shaped like this football, it would be just as happy to be this way as that way. There isn't any, being on the near side of the Earth isn't any more favorable than being in the far side of the Earth gravitationally. So people very much expected Mercury to have the same behavior, that it would be tidally locked to the Sun. But it's a pretty hard planet to observe, so it was actually, I don't know, maybe 50 years ago that people figured out that it wasn't tidally locked, or it was tidally locked in a very funny way. So the first thing to remember about Mercury is it has a highly eccentric orbit, so that it is sometimes close and sometimes further away from the Sun, with that eccentricity being about 20%. And what it does is funny and kind of hard to recreate, but what it does is when it's close to the Sun, a particular face of Mercury is going towards the Sun, and one orbit later, it's the other side that's facing towards the Sun. So it, you know, in terms of gravity, it doesn't really matter which face is pointing towards the Sun, but it's going to go through three spins in two orbits. So it has this three halves spin resonance. So kind of an old science fiction, there is the cold side of Mercury and there is the hot side of Mercury, and I guess that's true for a few weeks, but if you wait long enough, the hot side becomes the cool side and vice versa. Every side of Mercury is eventually facing the Sun. It's not a synchronous rotator. And presumably the fact that it is so highly eccentric means that it's caught in this favorable situation where it doesn't matter which side is facing towards the Sun when it's close, and things are less gravitationally important when it's far from the Sun. Okay, so a funny rotation rate for unexpected rotation rate for Mars, for Mercury, not as slow as it could be, not synchronous, but it has a situation, so every other at every perihelion, opposite sides of Mercury are closest to the Sun. Questions? So while we're talking about rotations, as we go on to think about these other terrestrial planets, notice that Venus has even a stranger rotation rate. The minus sign indicates that it's rotating backwards. So generally speaking, things are orbiting the Sun in the same way that they are spinning. So the Earth, if we're looking down from the North Pole, the Earth is going around the Sun this way, and it's also spinning the same way. So Venus is spinning backwards, but extremely slowly. So this is a very long rotation period in hours. So essentially it's not spinning, but technically speaking it's rotating very slowly backwards. Whereas Mars, very similar to the Earth in terms of its spin rate. The other thing that's maybe worth looking at is the axial tilt, the 23.5 degrees, 23.4 in this table for Earth. Pretty much the same for Mars, and you can see that for the fact that this is nearly 180 is what's the same thing as this minus sign. So it's rotating backwards, so its north pole is pointed down as opposed to up. So that's why we have a number close to 180 here, and you can see that for both Mercury and the Moon, the axial inclination is pretty small. Okay, so surprising rotations for Venus. Uranus also has a very odd rotation rate, but its oddness is that as it's orbiting the Sun, its orbit kind of is like this. That is to say, its orbital axis is nearly in the plane of its orbit. So sometimes the pole is pointing towards, the south pole is pointing towards the Sun, and half a Uranus year later, the north pole is pointing towards the Sun. So it has an inclination that is nearly 90 degrees. And technically speaking, it's a little bit more than 90 degrees, 97 degrees, I think. So that's why it counts as a retrograde rotating planet. Pluto would also be an exception, except we don't call it a planet anymore. Okay, so kind of the overall picture that I hope you have of planetary geology is that size makes a big difference. And that if we have a small object, it's going to cool off relatively quickly, and so there's not going to be the heat difference between the inside and the outside that's going to drive the volcanism that is going to make the planet geologically interesting. So in that regard, we have the Moon and Mercury on one side, which are small and have cooled off and are not geologically active anymore. And as we work our way up through Mars, Venus, and Earth, we're expecting more and more volcanic activity. And I don't know, you can decide for yourself whether it exactly pans out that way or not. Unfortunately, I mean, what we expect is that Venus, since it's very similar in size to the Earth, you would expect a priori that it would have very similar geology to the Earth, right? It would have these plates in motion. But I've already told you that it ain't so, right? That even though Venus and Earth are nearly the same size, Venus has a very different sort of geology than the Earth has. Okay, so let's start with Mars, which is kind of the intermediate case, and it works pretty well. You would expect that since it's intermediate in size between the Earth and Mercury and the Moon, it would have an intermediate sort of geology. So again, here's the setup. Venus and Earth, nearly the same size. Here's Mercury, here's the Moon, and here's Mars, kind of halfway. And that's kind of the way it works. So we've got half of Mars that looks pretty much like the Moon. It's heavily cratered. So this is, of course, a false colored map, right? It does look red, but it doesn't look that red, and it never looks blue. So the southern hemisphere of Mars is very old and cratered, looks just like highlands, and the northern hemisphere, not so much. And in particular, what we have close to the northern hemisphere is this area here, a very definite volcanic area. So we have these volcanoes and this huge region of uplift called the Tarsus Bulge. So this guy here, Olympus Mons, is the biggest volcano in the solar system, something like twice or three times the size of the biggest thing on Earth. There are volcanoes on Venus. They're pretty comparable in size to what's going on Earth. We also have this huge rift valley. So usually when we think of valleys like the Grand Canyon, we're thinking about water-caused erosion. But that's not what's happening here. This is more like a rift valley. It's more like the crust was pulled apart at that spot to make this huge crack that spans, you know, you can see a good fraction of the size of the planet. Much bigger than the Grand Canyon, much deeper than the Grand Canyon. Grand Canyon would kind of fit in a side pocket of this guy. So what this map is denoting with color is elevation. So what we have here are cratered highlands, like on the moon, and here we have pretty uncratered lowlands. And the color blue is maybe significant, because we do think that, well, let me phrase it this way, there is good sign, I would say, that there was water on Mars in the past. No water currently, it's dry, extremely dry. But there are features that pretty much show that there has been flowing water on the surface of Mars. And when we talk about the atmosphere of Mars, that'll take some explanation. Because currently, if you were to dump water on the surface of Mars, it would boil until it froze. So you can't have any water on the surface of Mars. So there's wonderful tool that Google has provided us that allows us to actually look at these pictures of the planets. If we can find the And so I think that's a good starting point to take a look at the So this is the same sort of map that we're looking at. It's a false color map where the color is giving you an indication of elevation. Generally speaking, Mars looks pretty red, and even looks red through the telescope, but just as a red dot. We can't see really any of these surface features from a telescope at least like ours, and historically any telescope. So all of these stories of canals on the surface of Mars and people making drawings of the surface of Mars, people have made correspondences between what turn of the century people saw through their telescopes and the facts that we now know from orbiting probes around Mars. And basically, there's no correspondence. So everything they saw in the telescope was really in their minds and wasn't part of the actual topography of Mars. So Hubble can do a pretty good job on imaging Mars, but we do, since it's outside of the atmosphere, but we can do a much better job, of course, by close observation from space. Okay, so here's this region that we were just talking. So here's down here in the south, we've got the heavily cratered region, but kind of the feature that is, we haven't seen anything like this in the solar system yet. Nothing like this on Mars, or Mercury, or the moon are these huge volcanoes. So this is Olympic Mars. This whole region is called the Tarsus Bulge. And kind of the best guess is this is a region that is being pushed up by hot material that's coming up from the mantle. So kind of like a hotspot volcano like in Hawaii, but because there aren't plates that are moving, everything's just getting piled pretty much at the same spot. Now you remember that the height of volcanoes depends on basically the pressure that's required to push the liquid rock up. So when we see very tall volcanoes, it must mean that there's either a big difference in density between the liquid rock and the solid rock, and we have no reason to expect that rocks are any different on Mars than they are on Earth, or it's because we have a big, thick iceberg, as it were. So the tall volcanoes on Mars probably are indicative of a very thick crust, so that we have a big vertical distance for those density differences to manifest themselves. Right? The bigger the iceberg, the taller the iceberg is above the ocean, the deeper it must be below the ocean. So the compensation depth for Mars must be a whole lot more than it is otherwise. So if we kind of zoom in on Valle Marineris, which is this big, again, not a river valley, presumably a rift valley where we have the crust that is kind of ripped apart. And over here we have this, someplace over here, we have this big area that is shaded blue just because it's low. But if we look at the boundaries of it, we start to see things that look like flow features that are flowing into it. So this looks for all the world like some liquid, pretty much has to be water, was flowing through here making these streamlined islands. If we look at some of these craters, they kind of have splash marks. You can see that there's, you know, looks for all the world like this was splashing, like this rock hit something like mud that splashed out, as opposed to the typical sort of lunar crater which lacks these sort of rings around the outside. So, kind of invite you to not just look at the pictures in the book on Mars, but you can go to Google/Mars and you can map it just the way you use Google Maps. There are nice tours that you can take, and there's a program called Google Earth, which oddly enough also will let you make tours of Mars, three-dimensional tours. It's a great way to kind of get a handle on what's going on in the planet. So, here just happening upon it, you can see something again that looks kind of like a meandering stream. So the best guess, one can't say with perfect certainty, I guess, but certainly the preponderance of evidence seems to suggest that there was open water, maybe oceans, maybe just big lakes on the surface of Mars. And a lot of that evidence comes from the rovers, because of course one of the things, we talked about the various types of rock. So far we've only seen igneous rock, basalts, anthracite, but one of the things that the rover has discovered is sedimentary rock, rock that has to be deposited under a fluid, and sure looks like it was deposited under water. There are lots of other kind of features that are maybe worth taking a look at. So we'll be talking about the atmosphere of these planets next time, but there's a picture of a tornado on the surface of Mars. We have these kind of big dust devils that we've had them go over or at least near the rovers, and mostly what they do is get rid of the dust that's accumulating on the rovers from more normal atmospheric phenomena. They blow the solar panels clean, which is one of the reasons they've survived a little bit longer than people hoped, because they usually just accumulate dust. And I think I actually have all these things hit if I go to the other one. No? Did I? Okay. I must have killed it. Okay, but I do actually need to use Firefox. Okay, so here they are. I'm waiting for that to load. It's a big image of this piece of Mars. One more time. So here's kind of this strip of Mars that we're talking about. We have a relatively big crater here. We have some flow features there. And we're actually zooming in on this crater here. So that's what this crater is. And we're going to be looking over, incidentally, in this crater we'd see sand dunes. That's a pretty common feature in Mars, to see windblown sand dunes. And we can judge the direction of the wind by which way the dunes are moving. Oops. So we're closing in on this area, and here's another one of these flow features. So this looks pretty much just like a river delta, where we have the outflow from some channels that are accumulating. And it doesn't look so good on the projection. Okay. So for Mars, it's got a transparent atmosphere, thin atmosphere. So we have these wonderful pictures of the surface, and we have pretty good evidence of a moderately active geology. The fact that half of Mars is cratered tells us that that half of Mars probably goes back many billions of years. If we try and count craters on the side of these volcanoes, it's a little bit tricky, but they're certainly a lot younger. How much younger? I don't know. People argue about it, but maybe 2 billion years would be a pretty good guess. So we think that probably not much has happened on Mars for billions of years. And kind of no surprise, there isn't any evidence of active volcanism on Mars. But again, that's kind of no surprise, right? If these volcanoes erupt every 100 million years, what would be the chance that we would catch them in eruption? Questions on Mars?
So since there was water on Mars a long time ago, was there a chance that there was life as well, or is that really at the top?
Well, so it's speculation, of course, right? The only place we know where there's life is on this planet. And lots of people, including me, believe that it probably isn't too difficult to grow life on other places. And so I would say, well, there are a few other kind of ifs, ands, or buts about Mars. But people have looked, so, So there are movies about life on Mars, right? And we know it's not like that. We've roamed rovers around the surface and we haven't seen any Martians. So there certainly isn't any big life currently. In 1976, they made a big effort to look for microscopic life on Mars. And that came up with ambiguous results, which are interpreted as no life on Mars. And what was detected that was ambiguous, and we'll probably talk about this in a month or so, was that so we have the ozone layer, which is protecting us from ultraviolet light, but Mars doesn't have an ozone layer. In order to have ozone, you have to have oxygen. In order to have oxygen, you have to have life. And currently, the atmosphere of Mars is thin and carbon dioxide. So ultraviolet light is exposing the surface 100% of the time. And we know that if you were to put E. coli on the surface of Mars, it would be killed by that ultraviolet light pretty quickly. But it also changes the chemistry of the rocks, and it makes them very chemically reactive. So some of these tests that were designed to find biologically active material, we think made results that looked kind of positive, and they're currently interpreted as being positive only because of a chemically reactive surface. So kind of the evidence for that is if it's life, you would think if you feed it once, it would grow, and you'd feed it again, it would grow even more, whereas these reactions that were detected by Viking on the surface of Mars were kind of one-time events. They added food to the rock, and it bubbled and boiled, you know, as if somebody was eating that food, but we think that that was just chemistry, and when we gave it another meal, nothing happened. So life is certainly not plentiful on Mars, and I think there's very good evidence that if you were to, you know, pick up a spade full of dirt and try and grow something from it, you're going to come up zero 100% of the time. But it's really a very different question to ask, well, how about if you don't look at the surface, you look deep, you look in cracks? I guess one of the things I didn't mention is there's this big polar cap on Mars, which is largely dry ice, but there is frozen ice also on in those ice caps. And even in very cold places like Antarctica, we find ice. So if we were to look for places that are protected from ultraviolet radiation, or maybe that are a little bit deep into the interior of the planet where it's warmer, maybe those are reasonable places to think that life exists. And unfortunately, all of those are more difficult to do, right? So we've done the easy thing, land a spacecraft in a reasonable place and do the obvious tests. The unobvious tests in difficult to reach locations are it's a lot harder thing to do. So, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, So I guess I have to say one more story. So we have rocks from the moon that were carried back from Apollo. We have rocks that the Russians carried back, pretty small quantities, on their robot spacecraft. We have rocks from the moon that we think were chipped off by asteroids. So, and of course we have lots of rocks from Earth. We also have rocks that we think were chipped off Mars. Mars doesn't have that high gravitational force, and it's quite imaginable that when asteroids hit, they would chip off pieces of Mars. And we have chemical compositions from the surface of Mars from these spacecraft, and these handful of meteorites that we have match that chemical composition. So that's not the best sort of evidence, but it's interesting sort of evidence that these dozen so meteorites may have come from Mars. So in one of these meteorites, there was a claim that they saw microscopic structures that were indicative of microbes. And I think it's fair to say no one believes that anymore. So there are lots of things that can make little bubbles in rock, and that's the general conclusion. So there was much hubbub about the possibility of having discovered life on Mars. But I don't know, NASA seems to have a propensity to do bad biology, is I guess what I would say. This isn't the first time they've, according to my wife, who is a microbiologist, have kind of blown the microbiology. So, no, in spite of things that you might have heard a few years ago, no evidence of life on Mars. I would say, and I think most people would say, no plentiful life on Mars, but possibly life in an obscure nook and cranny. And the kind of explanation for that, reasons to believe that, is it looks like life started on this planet pretty easily. That you waited 100 million years and you had an ocean and you got some bacteria that were starting to photosynthesize. And sure looks like there was probably water for that sort of time period on Mars. And it's, I would say, not at all outlandish to say that microbes were present on Mars when there was water. So then it's a question of, could they evolve fast enough to find some nook and cranny to continue to survive? So the negative evidence, the reason not to believe that there is, even in some nook or cranny, is that life really changes the atmosphere. So we know that life produces oxygen. It also produces all sorts of trace gases in our atmosphere that are clear signs that there are non-chemical processes that are going on, non-natural chemical processes that are going on. And there's no evidence for anything like that on Mars. So if there is life, for some reason, it hasn't done much to make even the smallest microscopic impact on the atmosphere, which we kind of expect it would. More questions? So even though, oddly enough, the first spacecraft that went by Mars, and it was a flyby, it's harder to orbit, this is exactly what it saw. So early in the 70s, people were really down on the possibility that there was anything interesting on Mars. Mars just looked to be another version of the moon. And you know, over the last 50 years, we start to see that there really was water on Mars. And if there was water, then things really were different. And we have all of this, at least moderately active geology, that indicates a much more interesting planet than say the moon is. Okay, so we got one other ball up here, that's Venus. So what's the story on Venus? So I've already let kind of the cat out of the bag. Venus is nothing like the Earth. We really expect it to be like the Earth. Same size, same moment of inertia, same density. Venus is not like the Earth, though. So what is it like, and maybe why is it different? So this is, again, another one of these false color images. And in this case, it's not based on photographs because Venus is got 100% cloud cover. So with an exception that I'll talk about maybe in a while, there are no pictures of the surface of Venus. So this is all done by radar. So we can do this actually from Earth pretty well too, but we put a spacecraft around Venus that radar mapped the topography. And the Russians actually have done the same. So we have a pretty good data set for the topography of Venus. And the first approximate statement is that Venus is flat. Much flatter than the Earth is. So the Earth has an odd distribution of altitudes. There are relatively flat oceans and there are relatively flat continents and they have different altitudes. So it has this kind of two-bumped distribution of altitudes. And on Venus, there's just one altitude that's common. The common altitude, which I don't know, we might as well call sea level. And 80% of the planet, I think, is within 500 meters of that altitude. So it's mostly flat, but there are some highlands. So we've got this, the biggest of them is this Ishkar Highlands that's in the northern hemisphere. Well, I don't know if now is the time to bite this bullet or not. So what way is north on a planet that's spinning backwards? And I think unfortunately, people have made, maybe you would call it the fortunate direction, that the northern hemisphere of Venus is facing the same stars that the northern hemisphere of the Earth is. And maybe that doesn't sound like too bad choice, but it means that everything is backwards in terms of the meteorology, which we'll talk about next time. So the Coriolis force in the northern hemisphere, as opposed to pushing things to the right, is going to push things to the left. It just is another source of extra confusion. But in any case, what we mean by the northern hemisphere of Venus is the same hemisphere that would be north if this were the Earth. So if you were standing here, you would see not exactly the North Star because the tilt is different, but you would generally speaking see the northern constellations as opposed to the southern constellations. Of course, you wouldn't see anything because you have 100% cloud cover and you would be dead because it's pretty hot. But those things aside. So we've got this big, Australia-sized, so not all that big, Australia-sized highlands called Ishkar, and it has the biggest thing there, which is called Maxwell Mounds. So this is a volcano, and in terms of its size, it's pretty comparable to the Hawaiian Islands, and it's a shield volcano. So you remember the kind of Mount Fujiyama volcanoes that are photographed have nice steep slopes, whereas shield volcanoes have very shallow slopes. The volcanoes on Mars are also shield volcanoes. So they cover huge, in order to get to relatively high altitudes, they cover absolutely huge areas. So Olympic Mounds has a base that is comparable to the state of Ohio. So we've got a handful of volcanoes. There's another relatively big highlands here. This exaggerates it by choosing what they're calling high and low. So this is the Aphrodite Highlands, and then there's another highlands over here called the Beta Highlands. So we've got Ishkar and Aphrodite and Beta. But mostly flat. So we have land. I said that we have no pictures of the surface of Venus. Not exactly true. So the Russians have landed 3 probes on the surface of Venus. Now, we'll learn next time that Venus has extremely nasty conditions at its surface. Temperatures that are hotter than the temperature of your oven, pressures that are like a kilometer down in the ocean. So those probes only last about an hour before they're destroyed by those very nasty conditions. So what those probes show is surface rocks. And first thing to stress is that they're rocks, right? If you take a picture on if you've looked at the pictures from the rovers, you see soil of some sort. Not earth soil, but crushed rock at least. Here we see rocks that are right on the surface, and they have the chemical composition of basalt. So pretty soon we're going to be thinking that these things are some sort of flood basalts that basically have covered the whole planet, with the exception of these handful of highlands. How old are they? Well, the best way we have of guessing ages, of course, is by counting craters. We can tell that this area is relatively new and that area is relatively old just by seeing that this has collected a lot of pot marks. So if we count craters on Venus, very few. Not none, but very few. Comparable to what we would find on the Earth. So we're thinking hundreds of millions, maybe 500 million years old. So that's way younger than anything we've talked about, right? Half a billion as opposed to several billion years old. And a lot of people would knock that down to 100 million years or something like that. Now there's a slight problem that's caused by that big atmosphere, because with that big atmosphere, small meteors are going to break up in the atmosphere and they're not going to hit the ground in the first place. But the big ones, which are the ones that are easiest to count, they're going to easily make it through, basically because they're as big as the atmosphere is. So the atmosphere is pretty small change. And even those, there are very few. So this seems to be a pretty good number. And the other thing is that it looks like these things are uniform. So unlike Mars, unlike the Moon, where we have very different terrains on different sides of the planet, it looks like all of the planet is the same age, say 500 million years old. So something happened 500 million years ago that resurfaced the planet. So I don't know, there are lots of things that are not being talked about, and maybe they need to be mentioned. So on Earth, we have nice linear mountain ranges like the Andes. We don't see anything like that. We have mid-ocean ridges and distinction between oceans and continents. None of the linear features that correspond to plates. So in short, all of the things that we think about in terms of the Earth's geology, plate tectonics, plates in collision, causing linear mountain ranges and causing uplifts like the Himalayas, none of that seems to be going on Venus. But Venus seems to be pretty similar to the Earth. And it certainly is, certainly has volcanoes, so it has some sort of active geology, and something has been happening relatively recently. There's some evidence that the volcanoes are currently active. And the data is kind of one-time event. So one's not sure exactly how to interpret it. So one of the first spacecraft that measured the atmospheric constituents on Venus found a lot of sulfur dioxide, and then over time that sulfur dioxide decayed away. And sulfur dioxide is something that's produced by volcanoes. So one interpretation of this is that there was a big volcanic eruption just before the spacecraft reached Venus, and there hasn't been one since because we've never seen a reoccurrence of this large concentration of sulfur dioxide. So maybe currently active. And when I say currently active volcanoes, I mean active in the last 100 years as opposed to active last week. We will see cases when we move out of the inner solar system where we have pictures of volcanoes in eruption on various locations. Okay, so no magnetic field. We're not going to interpret that as a sign of a different core, though, because the spin rate is so slow that it's not clear that it could sustain a magnetic field. So the density and everything else points to an iron core, much like Earth. With one exception that's worth reminding you about. So you remember I said that the separation of the Earth's core between the inner solid core and the outer liquid core, that was a close thing. That it would be easy to imagine a situation different that would produce a fully liquid core, for example. So maybe no solid inner core. But there's no evidence one way or the other, is I guess what I'm saying. But instead of thinking that Venus should be a Xerox copy of the Earth on its inside, the inner core is something that is just barely there, as it were, for Earth. So it's possible that Venus is just slightly different enough so that it lacks an inner solid core. But it must have a liquid core comparable in size to the Earth just based on the density of the planet. So why no plates? Why no tectonic motion? So Venus must be hot on the inside for the same reason that the Earth is hot on the inside, a combination of leftover heat and radioactively produced heat. How is that heat escaping? Why isn't it causing convection cells that move the surface of the planet along the way it works for the Earth? And of course, we don't know the answer to that question, and it's probably not a question that's going to be answered, I would say, in your lifetime, because in order to do that, we need to land seismic probes on the surface of Venus so we can image its interior. But the surface conditions are so extreme, it's really hard to imagine anything like a seismometer surviving any long period of time. And without plates in collision, there probably aren't a lot of earthquakes to measure. Right? That's the case with the moon. We have seismometers there, but earthquakes are few and far between and are typically caused by the tides of the Earth, and that would also be absent. So it doesn't look good for figuring out literally for directly measuring what's going on in, underneath the surface of Venus. But there are at least a couple of differences with Venus that may point at some reasons why the geology is so different. And those reasons have to do with it being hot and dry. So early kind of science fiction pictures of Venus had it being, you know, some sort of rainforest environment, and it's nothing like that. So Hot by itself, of course, is going to mean that the water is going to evaporate. But when I mean it's dry, I mean beyond the hotness. That is to say, even if you account for the humidity that you would have at those sort of high temperatures, it's drier than the Earth is. It actually has somehow or other lost water. There's less water present, even in the clouds. Add it all up, substantially less water on Venus than there is on the Earth. So that's something we'll want to explain when we talk about the meteorology of it. But in terms of the geology of it, these things have consequences. So dry rocks, dry hot rocks, turns out are a lot stickier than wet, moist, I should say, hot rocks. So this by itself will make the rocks stick together more. So it's not going to slide so nicely. The other thing that plays a role with hot has to do with the buoyancy. So you know that hot stuff is expanded stuff. So hot rocks are going to be lower density. They're going to be more buoyant. So another explanation is that the crust of Venus is so hot and buoyant that it just won't sink. But there's another consequence of hot that kind of goes the other way. So the, generally speaking, the lapse rate, the change in temperature with depth on the Earth, is on the order of 10 degrees Celsius per kilometer. That's pretty much, incidentally, the same number it is in the atmosphere, which is kind of surprising. So as you go down, it gets about as hot as it does as it gets cold when you go up into the air. So if we start at a higher temperature, you know, 500 degrees as opposed to 30 degrees, and we go down at the same rate, we're going to reach the melting point of rock faster on Venus than we are on Earth. So you would think automatically that the hotter surface of Venus would lead to a thinner lithosphere. You remember the lithosphere is the part of the Earth that is rigid. Below it we have the asthenosphere, which is the part that is partially fluid. So if we start hotter and we go down at the same rate, of course we don't know if we go down at the same rate on Venus, but if we go down on Venus at the same rate we go get hotter as we do on Earth, then we should reach the asthenosphere sooner, which means we would have a relatively thin lithosphere. So our book talks about a thin and flaky crust for Venus. So the idea here is that the crust is so thin that instead of kind of moving as a rigid object, instead it breaks up into lots of little pieces. And then episodically, you know, maybe every 500 million years, we get a big overturning of all of that crust and we have a major resurfacing event. So in this sort of picture, the idea is that the tectonic activity on Venus is kind of building up with heat under the planet, and then it kind of erupts all at once as opposed to leading to this kind of creeping flow the way we have on Earth. But all of this is basically speculation. The facts are that we don't have plates in motion the way that we do on Venus, and we dearly like to know why it is that the Earth is so unique in terms of its geology. So in the case of Mars and, well, the dead planets, as it were, of Moon and Mercury, I guess it's no surprise that there isn't plate tectonics. People have looked for signs of ancient plate tectonics on Mars without success. So it sure looks like for some reason, the Earth is unique in having these plates that are in motion, causing all of our interesting geology. And incidentally, perhaps playing an important role in life. There are people who believe that life probably had its origin in the hydrothermal vents that are associated with the mid-ocean ridges, basically because the surface of the planet would have been a pretty uncomfortable place early on, whereas a kilometer deep under the ocean might be a relatively safe place to be. Okay, questions? So we got volcanoes pretty much every place except the dead planets of the Moon and Mercury. We got the biggest ones on Mars, and height of volcanoes we think correlates with the compensation depth. So we probably have pretty thick crust on Mars, and that goes along with Mars being a smaller object, so it's cooled off more, so it has a thicker crust has built up. Venus presumably may even have a thinner crust, but actually the volcanoes on Venus are pretty much the same size as the volcanoes on Earth. Okay, so I think I'll call it quits there, and we'll go on next time to talk about meteorology. So we've got a big atmosphere for Venus to talk about, and we've got a thin atmosphere for Mars to talk about.